podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist?
Surely. Like you just poured a beer out of Matt Doherty's crotch.
It was really weird.
For listeners, Nick has a picture of Matt D as his background, so he's just
pulled
a beer
literally
out of his crotch.
I need to change that. Very cool.
You changed it to the Matt D awkward face now.
Yeah, should we go? Ready?
Yeah.
Hello. So the first game week is over, and we're recording at the climax of a Chelsea game, which rounded off quite a tumultuous opening weekend of the 2021 season. And we're here to begin our weekly podcast proper from here on in. Each week, for those new listeners, they normally go down like this. There's a game week review, Nick leads the market forces, then we'll analyse kind of one key topic in detail, followed by the mini league update, correspondence in the Q&A. And the correspondence in the Q&A are where we speak about all the other things which are going on in FPL, you know, and address all the hot topics, because the analysis bit, it's one kind of key topic that we've really done some research on, something that's been going on in the FPL zeitgeist, be it through social media handbags or maybe market forces. And we always try to provide kind of a database analysis to our opinions on that one topic, but in the Q&As and things like that as well, we'll give voice to the other things which are happening. We always try to keep it, you know, rounded off too. So when we do a key topic, we don't just give one side of the argument, we give both sides and allow you to make your own decisions. For returning listeners, welcome. You knew all that. Standard service resumes from here. And I'm joined, of course, by my two co-hosts. Nick, you all right?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Yeah, it was a certainly busy and exciting start to the season. We've got plenty of talking points for the pod, which is fantastic. Just a reminder of who we are. We are Who Got the Assist. You can find us generally on Twitter at WGTA_FPL or at WGTA_Nick or at FPL Stag. We're also on Instagram. If you are on Instagram, make sure to give us a follow there as well, WGTA.FPL. And new listeners as well, appreciate it if you don't forget to hit the subscribe if you like what you hear, and give us a rating as well if you really like the pod. If you haven't joined our mini league, the code is CPSULF. So, Anthony, how are you?
Evening, lads. Good to be back, and great to have a week of Fantasy Penalty League to look back on again. I learned a word over the weekend, bifurcating. Now, I'd never heard it before. Tom's nodding as if he knows it. No, yes. Maybe he doesn't. That pretty much, I think, gets to the nutshell of what this game week was. Bifurcate is, it's to divide into two parts.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what happened with FPL scores in the opening weekend of the season. In particular, thanks to Mohamed Salah's hat-trick with the help of two penalties, which brought him 40 points for those that were lucky enough to captain him. That was about 20% of managers. So the main part of our agenda, following on for that, will be considering penalties. A source of poxy points occasionally, or are they something that we have to really consider with all of our transfers and our picks? And then we'll also have our correspondence section, the mini league update, and Q&A. First of all, though, the game week review.
Yep, and as I finished bottom of the pile, I don't feel as bad about it now as I would have if tonight's game hadn't have shaped out how it was. But as I finished bottom of the pile for us in the game at one, I'll start. 71 is how I ended up with. It was 55 going into tonight. I had two men, Kai Havertz, who I was very excited about, and Reece James, who I had in, but I was a bit annoyed because I put Romain Saiss in, and he was one of the last ones that I removed for Reece James. Kai Havertz was very peripheral. First 10 minutes, I think he untouchable once, and yeah, absolutely diabolical numbers. Reece James saved my game week, basically. 14 points out of nowhere. Random screamer, literally about 30 seconds after losing the clean sheet to another bit of Kepa incompetence. And an assist from a corner for a deflected Zuma goal gave him 14 points. Yeah, really, really good. So up 71. I think it's about 750k or something. It doesn't really matter, does it? Game week one. Elsewhere, my other real performers were James Justin, Mo Salah. I didn't captain. I captained Aubameyang. I've got no regrets about that. I mean, those guys really put a gloss on what was otherwise quite an annoying game week in a lot of ways. So Richarlison, one of my big differential picks, had so many shots, one particular howler as well, and just didn't score. Whereas DCL got his one shot and scored it. So yeah, a bit annoying, but he did what I wanted him to do, which was take lots of shots. I was just hoping he'd convert. Shea Adams didn't score the one kind of clear opportunity he did have, and Trent basically was asleep at the wheel. A few people have said, oh, are you not annoyed about Salah? Not really. I mean, I always was going to captain Aubameyang against Fulham. It was always going to happen. As we'll talk about later on, there was kind of the penalty sort of thing going on, but equally Aubameyang's on penalties. So I'm not really too bothered about it. And, you know, 69% of the game didn't own Salah at the start of the game week. So yeah, pretty good to have those 20 points as a differential, which I will take every day. So yeah, 71 points. decent start, but I'm looking now to sell Kai, and we'll talk about that at the end of the pod. Who's next? I think it's is it Nick?
It is me. So yeah, I guess since we started WGTA, it feels like every single game we won has just been a complete shocker, hasn't it? And we're always like starting the first pod feeling a bit negative about how the first game week went, preaching, you know, positive and positivity and keep your head up sort of statements. But yeah, this year round, I'm pretty happy with 77 points. So that seemed like a really decent score. Like, my ORs dropped a little bit today because I only had Werner playing today. But yeah, I'm really happy with that score. Captained Aubameyang, so I didn't even captain Salah, I think. So 77 points and not captaining Salah feels really good. So Aubameyang got me 14, Salah got the 20 for the hat-trick. I also had Van Dijk in the end in my team, who got me a goal. So 7 points from him. I made the last minute swap from Doherty to Van Dijk, which seemed to pay off. And also, Werner got an assist tonight for the penalty, but also had Jamie Vardy, who got me another 2 goals, both from penalties, which is going to be something we're going to be talking about in depth today. So yeah, I'm pretty pleased with that, though. Feels a bit, you know, awkward having scored 4 of the 5 goals that I got from my players were from penalties, and I also got an assist from another penalty in the Chelsea game. So bit of a strange game week, but you know, I'm happy with that score. But yeah, one man did beat me though, didn't he?
I did. It's weird. I think I finished last season with a few game week topping ranks between the three of us on the trot, having had a horror season. At least I've started out the right way. I'm at about just under 400k, which I think means I'm already at a higher rank than I was ever at all last season, which says enough. A decent enough week anyway, 79 points. Really, the main reason is because of the Salah captaincy going through my team. I'm largely happy with my picks. Ramsdale, keeper, okay, this hasn't quite worked out. I ended up with no sub keeper, as it transpires, when I updated people from last week's pod. My defence, I had Trent, disappointing. James Justin really came out there with a 9 point. Matt Doherty, happy enough, to be honest, with what I saw from his positioning and getting into the box and things. But of course, 2 points is disappointing. And with Serge Aurier still there, I do fear rotation. I had Harrison Reed and Suchek in my midfield, but Suchek in particular was quite dangerous. So he looks quite a bargain at 5.0, but he's no penalty taker Jorginho either. Aubameyang is there, grand. Callum Wilson, happy that little punt paid off. Timo Werner is in there. He was at least a little bit involved, although Chelsea from open play, pretty disappointing. And Danny Ings, who, a bit like Che Adams, he had his chance, didn't take it. I probably only was going to have him for 1 week anyway. I couldn't afford Jamie Vardy with the kind of team composition I'd put together, so he had that striker slot for 1 week. Oh well, c'est la vie, didn't quite get his goal, but I'm pretty happy to get 79 points and actually start off on a positive note, like you guys.
Yeah, 70s. I think we're kind of happy with that. If you didn't do anywhere near that, then don't worry about it. It's still game week one. There's plenty of time to go. Like, don't panic, basically, is what you'll hear everywhere and something that we'd only echo. Let's move on then, after hearing our okay starts to the season, to the market forces. It returned as the transfer market opened, and I had great fun on Saturday writing out what's been going on. I think Nick started it by noticing that 7 managers sold Pepe before the lineups even got announced. So, and then it just kind of disintegrated from that to just ridiculous stuff like, you know, Salah had been sold by 10,000 managers, and then 1,000 managers went and sold him during the game when he's got the hat trick. The first week is absolutely mental. How's it looking now though, Nick, as the man across the numbers? Who are the movers and shakers?
We always get quite excited, as Tom said, from the first market forces of the season, just because it's always a little bit odd in terms of who's being bought. There's always a couple of bandwagons in there that just look a bit shady, a bit unusual, and we're kind of a bit like, oh, you know, like we've seen Xhaka and Higazi from a couple of seasons. I think that's the first season we did the pod, actually. I remember them being huge game week one bandwagons. But this season, actually, it's a guy we used to joke about a little bit, Tom. It's a guy we used to have a running joke in our first season of the pod. And that's Patrick Bamford. So we used to have a little bit of a joke where we'd talk about some of the Championship players and how they get on with the Premier League, whether they'd do well or whether they do a paddy. And this was kind of like, you know, these characters like Dwight Gale and Cameron Jerome, for instance, even Steve Meunier, you know, these players sort of like that would come from the Championship, do well, but like then basically do absolutely rubbish in the Premier League and struggle. And Bamford was one that we remembered fondly from, I think he got a 20 goal season in the Championship and then for Middlesbrough, and then he sort of only had one goal in sort of 326 minutes of game time, just struggled in the Premier League a little bit. But he's managed to match that score this season, hasn't he, already? So he's got his second goal in his Premier League career against Liverpool of all teams. And Leeds have Fulham up next as well. So at 5.5 million, he currently is the most transferred in player right now. And it's gone rapidly up, actually. So I looked at the numbers about 2 hours ago and he was at 99,000. Now he's gone right up to 150,000 transfers in. So a few people obviously clearly waiting until his game finished. But 150,000 transfers in for Bamford. I don't know what you guys make of that. Are you surprised to see him so high up on the market forces? Or is it just because playing Fulham, whipping boys and very cheap?
Oh, well, I actually took down the numbers about an hour before the Chelsea game. He was at 134K. So I just can't believe that 16,000 people have acted that quickly to get him in. Like, I think in many ways, what the Bamford move shows is, and I think when we talk about the transfers out, it basically shows that a lot of people are trying to invest money into midfield. And it'll make an awful lot more sense when we see it that way, as opposed to anyone kind of getting too excited about a good finish, but still a poxy finish against Liverpool from Bamford.
Yeah, there's also selling Mitrovic as well, which is probably just key. Because a lot of people have kind of gone, oh, look, Mitrovic, he hasn't played. Oh, this Bamford fella, he's around the same sort of price. He's done a goal. I'll get him in. Basically, that's probably all it is.
Probably. I mean, we're looking at the forwards. Ings is the fourth most transferred out player right now with 100,000 transfers out. He blanked. Obviously, people getting rid quite quickly based on the blank. And same with Mitrovic, didn't start, but, you know, he was supposed to be carrying a little bit of an injury. As a Mitrovic owner, actually, I'm probably going to keep him, I think, and take a risk, because the reason I had him in the team anyway was more for the game week 2-9 fixtures. And when he's fit, he will play. But otherwise, we've got Willian and De Bruyne, both being transferred in. Willian got a hat-trick of assists, 150,000 transfers in for him as well. So looking like a very popular pick at 8 million, started very strongly for his Arsenal career. And De Bruyne, he seems to be the player du jour in terms of the City and the United players that are being brought in. So 145,000 managers have brought in De Bruyne, 133,000 managers have brought in Bruno Fernandes as well, who's the fifth most transferred in player right now. He's knocked Salah out of the top five now. So I guess people starting to look at the United and the City assets and bringing those guys in. I don't think that's much of a surprise.
Yeah, you've got Bruno there, as you mentioned, and also Martial is the third most transferred in forward. So there's definitely people are kind of starting to look towards those United assets as they come into play. In terms of transfers out among midfielders, Son leading the way. People getting fed up with Sadio Mane, probably moving across to his Liverpool teammate Mo Salah, about the same amount of transfers out as transfers in between those, and Aubameyang as well. Among the mid-price midfielders, it's Saka and Alan Saint-Maximin that have lost people's patience somehow, even though they're 5.5 and you can't possibly expect them to return every week.
Yep, and finally, to cover the defenders, so the fourth most transferred in player right now is Gabriel of Arsenal, 139,000 transfers in because he got a goal, didn't he? So obviously, everyone's jumping on that wagon ahead of the West Ham game at home, but not sure about that for sort of a long-term
pick. Second goal of his whole career, I think it was.
Yeah.
Third goal of his career or something.
That's a Higazi special. I remember when we analysed Higazi in the preseason, said he'd never scored in his entire career. And of course, he went and scored in game week one, didn't he? And everyone jumped straight on that one. But interestingly enough, it's the second most transferred out player right now is Trent. And he's had 113,000 transfers out, another victim, I guess, of cutthroat transfers. And normally on this one, I suppose I would be like, well, what are you guys doing? He's a season keeper. But I'm not going to say that right now. And there'll be reasons for that that may become apparent later in the pod.
Oh, spoilers. Right. Okay. Let's move on then to the main topic this week, which is penalties. As Stag put it on Twitter and subsequently got accused of tweet stealing, Fantasy Penalty League.
It was complete fake news, by the way. The guy had tweeted it, but I'd never heard of him. He had like 400 followers. And I was like, who?
Always
hello?
Always
I was like, it was an obvious joke.
I know. Well, anyway, penalties arose this week as a hot topic issue in the community and, of course, a controversial subject. There are lots of arguments as Salah returned a hat-trick from a non-pen XG of 0.38 and Vardy a brace from 0.00. and Nick Harris had both of them in his team. So there you go. I'm not going to take my top off and record an angry video about that. Anyway, the arguments were in some cases hilarious histrionics that raged back and forth on social media and indeed many a WhatsApp group. So this week, as it's just the first week and we're quite low on data, we're instead going to focus on the key issue that the events the opener has passed us rather than deep diving into something around FPL. Well, I guess it kind of is related to FPL because obviously this week was all about penalties. But anyway, historically on pens then, a big thanks to FPL Chef for pointing me in the direction of the data I'm using here. What percentage do you guys think have been scored of all the penalties then?
I actually have the stat in my preparation, so I'll leave it to Nick.
It's probably 85%, I'd say.
Yeah, you're very close, yeah. It's 83%, so you've got, and you've got 17% chance of missing. So yeah, 2-2-1-4 penalties awarded, 1-8-4-1 scored. Clubs awarded most penalties in the Premier League history. Man United, 109. Shock horror. Second, Man City, 108. And Liverpool are third, 104. Chelsea are also in the 100 club. They've got 101 after tonight. Conceding the most penalties is Arsenal with 85. Not really a surprise there, given the centre-backs we've had over the recent period. Aston Villa with 83 and West Ham with 79. The last three seasons, there have been 91 penalties per season on average. The last 10 years, it's been kind of 92.4. So yeah, you're expecting around kind of 91 penalties per year. And over the last three seasons, it's been United 14, United with 12, and Palace 10 with most penalties over the last three seasons. The teams conceded, it's Leicester, Brighton, and loads of teams joined six in 2017-18. But the real consistency, as I mentioned, is Arsenal. We've consistently been huge penalty conceders. We've conceded the most of any team over the last few years, as I've mentioned, and consistently we come top five pens conceded thanks to terrible defenders like Mustafi. Anyway, the 14 pens won last season by United were the highest number of penalties awarded ever, and 15% of all penalties last season were awarded to United. The most penalties ever awarded in the season were 106 in 2009-10 and 2016-17, and most penalties ever scored were in 2009-10. Anyway, fun bit of research, but the key takeaways are that United are on for the hat trick, to the surprise of no one, in terms of penalties awarded. But City last year were only three behind them, and only one behind them in total stake. So yeah, Manchester United to some extent, but not entirely. But as we've seen over this weekend, it wasn't a handball. A bit of a cock-up has meant that penalties have been thrust into the zeitgeist once more. And is it those kind of new FIFA rules, I guess, which are causing an impact, do you think, Anthony?
We're definitely drawing on the useful research of both Wee Rogue and his podcast, and also Dale Johnson, who reports for ESPN. You'll find him at Dale Johnson. Now, Dale, firstly, he did a very useful thread on the new interpretation of what is a penalty for a defensive handball in the Premier League. And basically what it boils down to is if a player's arm is outstretched in a way that makes their body bigger to block a shot, you're going to get a penalty now. So for example, Liverpool's penalty where Cock handballed it when a ball was fired at him, his hand was dangling to the side. It was clearly too close to him for him to be able to react and get his hand behind him. But at the same time, that is now a penalty. Last season, that wouldn't have been a penalty because the Premier League's rule was very much in favour of the defender. And also, Dale Johnson has pointed out that the use of VAR screens pitch side, that was something which was in the Bundesliga last season and brought an extra 8 handball penalty decisions in. Overturning the initial on-pitch decision, referee goes to the screen, 8 more penalties for handballs. That was on top then of pitch decisions for handballs in the box. So if you extrapolate that for the Premier League, you're expecting about 10 more handball penalties for defensive handballs in the Premier League this season, just thanks to VAR. Wee Rogue also pointed out on Twitter that betting companies, who are some of the best at using stats to predict the world around us, and they expect the number of penalties scored in the Premier League to rise to about 88 goals. That was only, now think about this, there was only 72 goals scored from penalties last season. So they're expecting a 22% increase in goals scored from penalties. So broadly what that means, if you take the historic Premier League scoring rate of 83%, or what XG tells you is the Premier League scoring rate, which is 76%, basically the betting companies are expecting between 106 and 115 penalties to be awarded in the Premier League this year. And as Tom noted, given that 106 is the most we've ever seen before, the betting companies are nailing on that we're definitely going to see the most penalties that we've ever seen in a Premier League season this year.
Good. I'm very glad that we're getting this out of the way now, so we don't spend the rest of the season talking about penalties on the podcast. But yep, as I mentioned before, Vardy 2 pens, Salah 2 pens has really kicked the hornet's nest this week. There's kind of one side luck and people citing their non-pen XGs versus another perhaps saying, you know, for skill in picking pen takers, and you know, there's really benefits to having these players. So you know, you can't keep pointing to non-pen XG. What do you think of this argument? How do we assess this? I suspect we're all going to be on the same side, so we might have to build in some balance somehow. But initial thoughts then, guys, what do you think? Just to say as well, actually, before we get into it, it's touchy times at the start of the season, I know. Just please don't be offended by the below. We're giving our viewpoints, but we try to give a reasoned, balanced discussion. No one should feel personally offended apart from Adam Pritchard. Nobody
should. No, please be very offended by me. Please, please.
Oh. Right, let's continue. What do you guys think about this?
As the beneficiary of 4 goals from penalties as well as 2 assists, I guess I can't help but feel a little bit bashful. But I feel like some of the criticism and vitriol that we've seen on the internet has been a little bit unwarranted, and you know, like people complaining about the fact that their, you know, opponents' players got penalties. And just, you know, like everyone should calm down a little bit and just expect, you know, accept that it's part of the game. Penalties are a huge element of FPL, not a huge element, but you know, they're an important thing to think about. And you know, Vardy and Salah actually both won 2 of their own penalties anyway, so that could have been a goal-scoring opportunity at that particular moment that was hindered by the poor defending that was going on against those promoted clubs they were playing. And both were playing promoted clubs. And, you know, I had Vardy and Salah, and the reasons those guys were in my team is because they were playing promoted clubs. They were both literally, you were talking about 3 golden boots in 3 seasons between the 2 of them. You know, these guys are, they're in my team for a reason. They scored plenty of goals. And I know that, you know, they've also had the stats. We've seen some of the stats about Jamie Vardy. So in defence of Vardy, a lot of people said he's had a bad game, was ridiculously lucky to have got his returns in the game. But I'm sure, you know, obviously FPL, there's always a little bit of luck involved. We know about that. But, you know, he did have a shot on target that was ruled out for outside, so that gets excluded from the stats. He's also been a player that's always defied stats. He's in my team for a reason, even though he's not necessarily the most statistically friendly player in the game, isn't he? But I don't think he played badly. A lot of people said he played so badly. How the hell did he get points? What's that all about? But he was always making runs and looking a threat, looking a danger. And his role in the team, sorry to kind of take it on a bit of a tangent here, but his role in the team isn't to win the ball or try and take on an opponent, to drop deep and get involved. No one cares about any of that. You know, it's irrelevant to FPL. His role is to stay central, create space for the opening and wait for the winning ball to get on the end of, which he very often does and scores.
Yeah, enough to win the Golden Boot last season, often due to his open play contribution, even though he barely touches the ball. Like, for me, with the penalties and seeing the debate that broke out over the weekend, like, I was just screaming in my head, we've had this before. Tom's noted United's ability to draw penalties. Yep, 14 last season. Even in Bruno's time in the Premier League, of his 8 goals, 4 of them came from penalties. He wouldn't have been the player that we're talking about now if it wasn't for penalties. Milivojevic, a few seasons ago, he scored 7 goals from penalties one season. The year after that, it was 10 goals from penalties, to the point that last season he was priced at 7 million at the start of the year. Like, we know that penalties are a pretty big factor and can be a huge contributor in FPL. And I do see where the other side is coming from in that, okay, usually we talk about form, fixtures, underlying data, and then the skill is picking someone based on those, planning your transfers to hop on and hop off players as they come. Okay, fine. But at the same time, erratic moments do happen in football. Like, defenders have howlers, goalkeepers have howlers. Think about the Aubameyang brace against Norwich last season. And those, of course, fly in the face of what is predictable. Penalties are the same. And the fact of the matter is that there is a skill to drawing penalties. There's a reason why Manchester United continue to get the most penalties. And some people will say it's a cooked up conspiracy. I'll say it's because they have quick and agile players that are able to draw penalties. It's just part of the game. There's a reason why Milivojevic was getting so many penalties, basically because of Wilfred Zaha. It happens. And so when it comes to picking penalty takers, it kind of reminds me of that quote that's always accredited to Gary Player. The more I practice, the luckier I get. And for FPL, it's the more pen takers I have on my side, the better positioned I am to benefit and get lucky from penalties.
No, I think I'm broadly in agreement with both of you, which is why we need to take the other side of the argument in a minute. But basically, I think MPXG was being used a little bit to artificially elevate an otherwise simple argument. Penalties are still goals. Shocker. Expected goals do not score you FPL points. Goals do. I love a non-penalty XG as a stat, I should say. It's my top stat looked at by far in terms of judging player threat, and it helps identify who's getting both quality and quantity of chances. If you don't like that, you listen to the wrong pod, frankly. But as Desperately Seeking Doozan put it on Twitter, there's a great sense of kind of doublethink at times. We list pen takers, we know who they are, we count people to having penalties to take in the plus column for a player. But if it's a player we don't own, we're very quickly to say, oh, it's just penalty, and discount the impact, even though it's still a goal, you know? You don't win the lottery through nearly matching all the numbers. You don't win a hand on poker through nearly getting a full house on the river. And expected goals don't score FPL points, I'm afraid. Like, I've got huge sympathy for those who are upset that it didn't work out, and it was a bold strategy to go without Salah, for example. It was just one game week, as I've noted. And as I said on Twitter over the weekend, almost 7-10 managers didn't own Salah. So if you didn't, you're in the majority. And many who own Salah didn't capture them as well. But you know, equally, as we said on the pricing pod, literally, well, he's 12 million and Mane's 12 million. And Mane's really screwed over there, because Salah having the penalties is a huge plus in his column. You knew the risks going without him in the same way that I knew the risks of going without Werner. If Werner had gone big tonight, then I'd be saying, yep, I knew what I was doing.
And not to layer on the pepper and the salt on people who've picked Mane instead of Salah, but the fact of the matter is, as well, as we pointed out, the fact that Salah was, you know, bang on his XG and was, as we all saw it, quite unfortunate. Mane was overperforming on his XG, was only just about ahead of Salah last season, one goal more. And yet we all felt he'd had the season of his life to achieve that. There was a reason why we were really kind of surprised by them both being priced at the same price. And whilst I do sympathise with those that picked Mane, because of course he's a great player and he will have as many days in the season where he outscores Salah or just under it, at the same time, you can't exclude penalties when it suits you.
No, definitely not. I mean, Nick, I mean, Anthony has said, and I've said, you know, we can see where the other side's coming from. And we do look, use the underlying data. We do look at non-pen XG a lot of the time to try to filter out the quote-unquote noise that penalties could be. What do you think about this? Do you think that the other side does have a point? Or the other side, I'm saying, but people who are kind of saying, oh, it's all luck, do you think they've got a point here? Or like, would you say it's kind of somewhere in the middle?
I think we all know that luck has a massive role in FPL. It is a skilled game. We've seen that from the sort of the people who have been at the top of the game so many seasons in a row, like, to sort of play FPL and to get top 10k results, you know, every season you do require a lot of skill. But there is a luck element to the game as well, and we see that as well, actually, from the missed penalties and elements like that, you know, these sort of things that I can't remember how many, you'll have to remind me how many penalties your players missed in a row. I mean,
10 in a row in the first season we did WGTA,
That's mental. I mean, I remember last season as well, in game week 37, I had both Ings and Sterling miss penalties in the same game week. So people might say I've been lucky this game week to have 4 penalties, but I've been unlucky in the past. And it's just, you know, it's just part of the game. It is a factor. We all know luck is a factor. And it's very, very frustrating when you feel like you've been hard done by luck, ultimately, and, you know, the penalty element. But, you know, I think penalties still is a key role in the game. And it is something that we do think about a lot. I mean, when you talk about penalties being important, we do consider it quite important. But then I guess we didn't really think too important. We didn't think about Jorginho much, because I guess we need to talk about him briefly. At 5 million, we were all on the Suchek wagon, weren't we? We were fully on the Suchek wagon. We never thought, oh, Jorginho, 5 million penalty taker. Should we be bringing this guy in, you know? So I think that's something perhaps that's worthy of consideration as well.
I think that was because of Kovacic being suspended. That's why Jorginho was playing, or at least the perception. But no, I know what you mean. And I can't say that it's all about luck, that's for sure. I mean, as I've mentioned, I can appreciate why, as I mentioned earlier, you may be kind of taking comfort in the fact that a lot of luck didn't go your way if you kind of didn't have Salah, didn't have Vardy. Well, most people didn't have Vardy, but didn't have Salah as well. And I completely understand why you'd be kind of thinking, well, without penalties, things would have been so different, and kind of grasping for that sort of note of reassurance. I mean, this week I'm doing that to some extent too, don't forget. I mean, Aubameyang scored 1, had another kid off the line, and was looking an okay captain until Salah blew out of the water. And because penalties is a reason why I'd not be too hard on myself about that as well. But don't forget, Aubameyang was also on penalty, is also on penalties for Arsenal. So it could have gone the other way completely. And I could be sitting here having, you know, the espousing all of the things about it being complete skill, having a pen taker. The fact is, I think that pens is a very important attribute for a lot of players, especially when we're making our FPL picks. I mean, do you guys think that picking pen players is a valid tactic as part of FPL?
Well, I think where it's particularly useful is picking between two players in the same side. You know, often the talisman is the main goal scorer, so it's not a problem. But when you've got, for example, again, it's the Salah Mane debate. It's the Baines or Coleman debate during the David Moyes era at Everton. Of course, you went for the penalty taker in there, even when he was 0.5 or even a million more, because the fact of the matter was his ceiling was so much higher. So you just can't ignore it. And anyone who kind of tries to ignore it or says it's not a factor, I feel they're kind of ignoring fact to suit themselves.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. And I think Bruno perhaps is another excellent example of where picking penalty takers is a valid tactic. So when I was looking at the Manchester United players that I wanted to own for this season, my favourite out of Bruno, Rashford and Martial was Bruno. Not necessarily because he's the most attacking of all the three, but he has that penalty element. And that was so critical last season. We saw it was a game week 30, 33, 34 and 38. He scored penalties. And, you know, I know that was perhaps an unsustainable ratio that we're not going to see over the course of the season. But still, it's a big, big factor in terms of me thinking about my favourite, my optimal Manchester United pick. And I think, you know, as you said earlier, it's just those players, the likes of Zaha and Rashford and Mo Salah, that, you know, they have so many penalty box touches these days. And you can really look at the penalty box touch stats quite a lot, that they can win these penalties because you've got these lumpy defenders, you know, that just have to just like hack them down. Ultimately. And, you know, same with Eden Hazard when he was at Chelsea as well. It was another one that's fantastic for winning penalties and taking penalties as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our mate Simon, Analytic FPL, I think put it best. He said penalties boost the output, so we should adjust our models. We don't have models, but you know what I mean, to take account for that, but also realise it's a very noisy metric, so we should use expectation of them rather than small sample actuals, which basically translates into English means see it as a bonus. Which I totally agree with, frankly. Nick's example of taking Vardy on is a very, very good one. You can't, I mean, it was 0.0 MPXG, yes, but over the course of the last three seasons, Leicester have had seven and six penalties over the last 3 years. Yeah, we're not building a zombie team, but it's worth mentioning that penalties is a huge bonus if you think a player like him is good for open play goals in the teens as well. I might draw a line, though, on buying a player because of penalties alone. So you've got your Vardy, you've got your Bruno and stuff like that, but perhaps less often would I be thinking of, you know, maybe the epitome of somebody who could have been picked for penalties alone is Milivojevic at Crystal Palace, as Stag alluded to earlier. And they had 21 penalties between 2017 and 2018. But last year, they only have three, which saw him fall off a cliff as an FPL asset, coinciding with Zaha's drop-off. Milivojevic is actually the sixth for all-time penalty goals scored in the Premier League history, 21. He scored 27 goals in total in his Premier League career. 77% of them have been penalties. In fact, if you throw in the three free kicks he scored as well, 89% of his end product in the Premier League is from set pieces alone. So yeah, ridiculous. But I wouldn't say that that's a player that I'd be looking at. I mean, maybe if it does get to the point where penalties have been handed out like candy, then perhaps I'd be looking at it. But definitely look at it like a bonus, I think, and definitely, you know, it should be a huge plus, especially if we do get the environment, like Stag has mentioned right at the top, that penalties become a bit more kind of prevalent and a bigger kind of factor in this year's Premier League. I guess that leads to the final question and the title of this kind of pod, and I've already given my answer in some respects. How important do we think penalties are in FPL? For me, I think it's a fact of life, as I've mentioned. It's a nice bonus to the players, with the degree of importance attached to a player having them compared to the nature of the team they play for and the type of player they are. Do I want the Milivojevic? Probably not. Do I want a Bruno? Do I want a Vardy? Yeah, a definite consideration, of course. Yeah, it's a bit random as well, but it's nothing we should ever diminish. It's pure luck. You've got to put yourself in a position to score and get those points in the first place, as Nick has, and I guess we have with Salah this game week. What do you guys reckon? How important are penalties in FPL?
I think I'll try and be quite succinct because I think we've addressed most of it. But what I'll probably boil it down to for me is this. When it's an elite player, your Aubameyangs, your Salahs, your Manes, when you're trying to compare between those and pick one of them, penalties are a bonus for Bruno as well. It's a bonus. When it's a penalty taker who's quite cheap at a smaller club, Leighton Baines of years ago, Milivojevic of a few seasons ago, I think it can be a decisive factor then when a player is as cheap as they are. If Jorginho turned out to be nailed on, don't think he's going to be, at 5.0, having a penalty taker from a team like Chelsea, that's a pretty good reason to have him in and of itself. But as I say, for the elite players, the ones that we're mostly talking about in this podcast week in, week out, it's just a bonus.
Yeah, I think you see a lot of correlation between the penalty taker at a club and the talisman at the club. And certainly when I'm looking at who I'm picking in my FPL team, I look at, you know, who's on penalties, and it is something I factor in. And I do the same as well for set pieces and corners and stuff like that. It's something that is factored into my approach. It's not the do-all and the end-all of who I pick in my FPL team. But if I'm looking at someone like between Salah and Mane, then penalties is something that definitely sways me towards picking Salah over Mane ultimately.
Yep, I think that makes sense. Sounds like we're all in agreement, which I know isn't what normally happens, but there we go. Hope that was a nice rounded discussion, at least, on the importance of penalties in the fantasy football. Right, let's take a break there and move on to the mini league update and the Q&A after this.
Who got the assist?
So we're back, and normally we do the Who Got the Assist mini league. We're not going to give a full update this week, but we can see that I think there's about 12 or 13 people around sort of the 100, 103, 104 mark. Some really high scores there. A lot of guys captain Salah and did really well. So well done to all the guys who are top of the mini league for this game week. We'll probably continue on with normal updates as of next week. But we'll move on swiftly to the correspondence section. So Stag, you've had some interesting correspondence from Adam Pritchard, and I think you're going to be giving a highly edited a repeat of what he sent us via email.
Yeah, it's slightly edited, but maybe first of all, so we have some confusion, folks, about what this correspondence slot actually is. This is not the quickfire Q&A section. This is so much more than that. This is your chance to really give your opinion, to slap down whatever we might have said on a previous pod, or to start up a discussion on something that's close to your heart. So, like, please do get in touch and make the most of it before Tom and Nick call the segment, because it's causing so much confusion.
Yeah. So, yes. Questions on speed. Questions 2.0. It's deep questions with us three.
Yeah, real talk, but your talk. I don't know.
Talk to priests in your area.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Talk to priests you want to get to know. Anyway,
someone who has got the idea of what this segment is, as you said, it's the Arsenal fan, it's friend of the pod, it's the pun maker extraordinaire, and all-round good guy, Adam P, who's at 35who on Twitter. That's all one word, and those are all words as well for the digits. Anyway, he says, "Dear any old Tom, Nick and Staggy, I'm sure, like me, you've been watching Amazon's ironically named All or Nothing series, documenting Tottenham's 2019-2020 season. At the time of writing, I have watched the first 5 episodes and found them worryingly endearing towards some of the players, Eric Dier, Danny Rose and Japhet Tanganga in particular. Thankfully, Mourinho is still a prized, as the kids say, a prized C. Daniel Levy is still up his own arse, and Harry Kane's team talks are as inspiring as a failed political campaign speech. Determined to be as cynical as possible, this has all had me thinking of a couple of questions. Number one, which Premier League player do you think would give the least inspiring halftime team talk? And number two, which 3 Premier League players would you most like to have lunch with in a club canteen? Thanks, and apologies for reading this, and for all the hard work that goes into the pod. Hugs and kisses, Adam."
Oh, thanks, Adam. That's a very nice. Very nice indeed. So, I guess in terms of these, I mean, the Harry Kane's team talks are just hilarious. The man is no orator, is he? Like, absolutely not. If anyone does have a chance...
Come on, guys, we can effing do it. Go!
If anyone does have a chance, just watch it. It's so funny. I mean, bless him. He's trying really hard, but he's just not an Obama-esque articulator, orator, inspiring individual. He just is not, in terms of the words. If you watch All or Nothing Brazil, in contrast, Danny Alves is absolutely fantastic. So yeah, it's very much night and day in regards to those two. In terms of the questions anyway, who would I not like to give a half-time tea talk? It just reminds me of like on Football Manager, I always put the most ridiculous person as being the person who's doing the press conferences. So I always have like the German first team coach doesn't speak English being the guy who does the press conferences for me. It's something that's hilarious. And I think in terms of giving an inspiring half-time team talk, I think Danny Rose from watching that would be fantastic. Just for giving the worst half-time team talk ever. I don't even want to be here. So I don't really care what you do. It would kind of be what he'd say.
Is that Milan on the phone?
Yeah. Genoa? Sorry, lads. Genoa? Oh, yeah. Just go out there and do something, lads. And the three players to have dinner with in the canteen, I kind of thought, well, who's going to make me cry if I sit down and eat with them? Who's going to laugh at me relentlessly? Who's going to make me, you know, feel really small? And I thought of Premier League houses. And as a result, Neil Maupay, Ashley Barnes and Jamie Vardy. If I saw those three at a table, I'd walk away, frankly. Those would be the three that I would not want to sit with for my meal in the canteen. I'd love to see if I could hold my own against such exalted company in that canteen. So, it'd be a challenge at least. So I think those three would be the ones that I'd go with. But yeah, there you go. What about you guys?
I think taking the mick out of documentaries on football clubs, I think the Manchester City one was pretty funny, wasn't it? When Fabian Delph gave his rants, just about the basics of the game, isn't it? You see sort of 10 hours of Pep and all his skillful, breakdowns and team talks, and then you just get Fabian Delph like ranting away, saying it's all about the basics of the game. You've forgotten the basics of the game, and I don't know if many of his teammates found that particularly inspiring, but I certainly found that very entertaining. In regards to, I guess, Premier League clubs that I'd least likely like to hang around with, probably most of the Arsenal guys, so probably like Jack Wilshere, Guendouzi. I'd probably throw Mitrovic in there as well, just because I've got some sort of random hatred of that guy, especially after he blanked me this game week. So I've added him to the gang of three as well.
Uninspiring team talk. Who would give the least inspiring halftime team talk? I think Kepa, given his current situation in that Chelsea team. I would just love to see him trying to get the lads G'd up and just all of them looking at him, just not believing in him. That would be quite an image.
It's a long shot, Stag.
Yeah, it's a long shot. And then he'll probably drop the long shot too. And in terms of players that I'd like to have lunch with, I'm going to bring a Premier League player past and hopefully future into this as well, in having Patrick Bamford, Declan Rice and James McLean in this, purely because I want to see the interaction between Bamford, eligible to play for Ireland but hasn't decided to yet, Declan Rice, three times capped Ireland international and international friendlies, and James McLean, who wouldn't take too kindly to either of their one leaving the Ireland fold and one not deciding to play for Ireland. So I'd love to just play off the three of them for a few hours. And honestly, you could probably say it would be an awful lunch too.
Right, let's move on to the Q&A before we get into that. Let's start off with Andy Penman's question. He asks, in terms of the first week, 1 week wonder, how much can we really take from 1 week's worth of information? And Nick and I were just saying in the break, actually, that this is what we did last year. So we looked at every game week won in the past and thought about how that would kind of translate into kind of what we learned from this first game week. That was a good overview question, of course, in terms of how we're going to answer the rest of the questions. So, 1 week, do you guys think we can take anything from it? How important is it? Do we need lots of data? What's going on? Nicholas?
I mean, in the opening week of the season, we always have limited data to work from, don't we? So we don't tend to necessarily read too much into the statistics. For instance, you know, we see Bamford top of the market forces this week, but we don't expect him necessarily to be scoring week in, week out, for instance, you know. Same with some of the other guys, like Dominic Calvert-Lewin or other characters like that. But, you know, I think there's certainly early indications that you look at and you wonder, is this going to be a trend for the season? Is this something new? One example of worrying trends perhaps that have emerged over the course of this game week is Liverpool defending very poorly might have limited us a little bit in terms of, you know, or knocked our confidence perhaps in regards to trusting the Liverpool defence just based on the one game week. Even though it's only one game's worth of data, it was still quite concerning to see how poor they were defensively. Other statistics, you know, likes of Spurs as well, and they looked very, very poor, and that is concerning for many a Spurs fan like myself, and many an FPL manager who has a Spurs asset in their team. But otherwise, we also have some of our inherent biases that we had pre-season have been vindicated to a certain extent, and we feel more confident in regards to. And examples of these are the likes of Fulham being rubbish, or the likes of West Ham being rubbish. You know, we feel more confident about the likes of, you know, I think probably captaining Aubameyang's West Ham or targeting teams like Fulham. Certainly from 1 week's worth of data, we're certainly looking at that and thinking, I believed this in the preseason, and I'm still feeling confident about this particular thought process.
So I think I'm going to be overlapping you like Matt Doherty a little bit here, but it's a double-edged sword when it comes to week one data. You can't extrapolate on every statistic, but because, of course, the story of every game is different. You come across different systems, different opponents, you have different teammates around you, you get into different positions. So, okay, it's somewhat limited. But at the same time, take something like Arsenal recording their lowest expected goals conceded away from home in 5 years. It probably doesn't tell us that every issue in Arsenal's defence is solved, but it probably does tell us, as Nick noted, that Fulham have a pretty steep mountain to climb if they want to survive in the Premier League and really need to get their attack together and get Mitrovic fit. So what I do think you can pay attention to in week one isn't something that we tend to look at in underlying data, but it's stuff like positioning, touch maps. Was a player getting in unusually threatening positions? Matt Doherty, for example, he was getting forward well. He had Spurs' best chance. The team are clearly going to struggle to score, but at the same time, Matt Doherty looks well placed to get 5 goals and 5 assists, let's say 10 attacking returns in the season and 10 clean sheets, perhaps, considering if he starts consistently, considering that Spurs team is effectively set up to not concede and nothing else. Likewise, in the same game, Richarlison, he looks quite good to me. One bad miss, but getting in plenty of good positions. He had the most shots of any Everton player. He was in loads of decent positions. He's linking up really well with James Rodriguez. And only Willian had a higher XG without scoring this week. You could also say that is a negative thing, but leave me at it. Contrast that with Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Obviously, he's now going to be a popular pick, but he had just 2 attempts. Like, he's managed to score, so you're going to be talking about him. And a lot of people will call the screen grab of when Richarlison blazed rounding the keeper and blazed over the bar, and Calvert-Lewin was there ready for a tap-in if he passed it. The fact of the matter is, Richarlison is still pretty selfish. Dominic Calvert-Lewin still isn't that involved, and he had a good nod for his goal, but at the same time, he's probably not the better FPL pick long-term versus Richarlison. And maybe in the overall scheme of things, you could say it's pretty promising for Everton going into game week 2 against West Brom, who were especially poor in the second half against Leicester. Although they conceded twice from penalties, overall, they weren't that good. They were pretty uninspiring, and you would expect Everton to dominate them like they did Spurs with a fairly defensive, fairly poor midfield team. West Brom and Spurs pretty much the same in that regard.
Hold on, are you espousing Richarlison propaganda? Did I hear that right? Didn't you hate him? Did he make you feel sick last season?
New season, new me.
Fair enough. I'm right behind it as a Richarlison owner. I'm biased Richarlison owner. No, he did exactly, as I said at the very top, what I wanted him to do. And I think in terms of what 1 week's worth of information can do, very much delineates between players that we know a little bit about and players we don't know anything about. So a player like Matt D, I completely understand where Stag's coming from. You know, he's getting in the right positions. He's replicating the kinds of patterns of behaviour that we did see when he was at Wolves. It's just a case of getting that end product in. A player like Richarlison, who I owned, he's going to take a lot of shots. That's definitely true. And it's just a case of hoping that gets converted. But where those shots coming from, they're coming from balls fed by the man who made the most key passes this game week, James Rodriguez. And I think he's a very good example of the kind of thing that we do take from the first week, which is an eye test view, or at least it's an eye test understanding of how well these players do, sometimes mixed with stats.
Of Richarlison's 7 shots, 5 of them came from passes by James Rodriguez.
I think one of them was a BCC as well, incredibly. Mm-hmm. What's really cool as well is that it helps you kind of think, well, you know, some of these players like James, who looked very promising, Timo Werner tonight looked very promising, I felt. The newly promoted players, you know, the likes of Harrison, I think he was very promising. Click was very promising as well for Leeds. And I'm very glad that I've got Luke Ayling in my squad. I think that he was bombing forward to get involved with the attacks. At one point was in a central position. So I'm very happy with him. But one thing that perhaps kind of helps you do is to just kind of hone what maybe hasn't worked for you as well. So, I mean, a lot of people do look at it and kind of say, right, I'm not going to, you know, but I saw FPL General, at least he said, you know, no Chelsea players, and I'm going to wait and see what happens. Some of us do like to take a punt, remembering the, you know, the Mo Salah example of the past, even though, yeah, he was known to the Premier League, but come on, he only had a handful of appearances for Chelsea. So this game week, for example, I owned Kai Havertz because I bought him. I thought he was very good in the Bundesliga when I watched him for several games for Bayer Leverkusen. And watching him for Chelsea, I just don't think he's up to speed yet. So I think that he is now a little bit on the chopping block. We'll talk about that for a question later on. And that's kind of what game week one can be quite good for, which is kind of just seeing how everyone kind of seems to be. Of course, that could be kind of a false positive in some ways. You could be kind of thinking, oh, you know, God, you know, this player looks terrible. Then come game week two, three and four, they really take off, or vice versa. But I mean, it's really about impressions rather than facts. So much in game week one, and really it's about, you know, with the established players we know, those players will have a lot more patience in. With the players who are a bit newer to the Premier League, maybe we are able to kind of take an early barometer perhaps of what they're likely to do. And in the case of Kai Havertz, with me for example, maybe I'm thinking, oh, maybe I've erred there and maybe I need to correct that. Cool. All right, let's move on to the next question then. And it's KDB or Sterling? Players who we've completely forgotten existed because they didn't appear in the first game week.
I'd say this is the only time we'll have this question this year.
Oh, God. We're going to have this one. We're going to have, how important are penalties in FPL from non-listeners and things like
Bruno,
that?
Bruno, Rashford or Martial?
Yeah, that's going to happen a lot. But anyway, KDB or Sterling? Friend of the pod, Karim Tizer, has asked us about KDB and Sterling. He notes that KDB has an imminent price rise during the week. And he asks, would you find a way to get him in for, you know, 0.1 more than his current price, so you've got to, you have like, you know, 0.4 million in the bank or something like that, or would you be happy to wait and see and just grab Sterling next week? And that kind of 0.5, of course, at the moment, as we said on the Unwritten Rules pod, can be a bit like 0.1 at the moment because of how things kind of change and how limited a lot of the price rises and falls are going to be. So are we going to be trying to jump on KDB? Is KDB our first priority? He does have penalties. We didn't mention that too much earlier on. Or are we going to be happy with Sterling at 0.5 million? And 0.5 million, assuming the KDB rises first. Which one would you pick, Nick?
So before the fixtures were announced, when the website first launched and when we saw the prices, I was actually quite heavily shipping Sterling over De Bruyne. And then I kind of like, as kind of the week kind of went on, I kind of ended up like leaning more towards the De Bruyne camp. And that was kind of more, it was more to do with ownership fears, actually, just because I saw how highly owned De Bruyne was looking in the game compared to Sterling. But what I liked about Sterling was his explosive nature and his ceiling, which I think is a lot higher than De Bruyne, because Sterling kind of has a bit of a hat trick in him and stuff like that, and he's an excellent FPL asset. And I think actually, like, taking ownership out of the equation, which is out of the equation, because neither of them are going to be highly owned next week, just because of the fact they didn't have a game in game week one, I'd be quite tempted to take a hit if you were bringing either one of those guys in and you had the money, and I'm very jealous of the fact that you do have the money to bring either one of those guys in. I'd perhaps be tempted by the Sterling punt, and I just think that perhaps he's got more of a higher ceiling and more of an explosive differential nature. As we saw in the market forces, De Bruyne is going to rise, Sterling isn't necessarily going to, and if, you know, if Sterling falls, then you could have a huge return there.
So I've been thinking about this, and I think what the question really boils down to from Karam is, it's much more so, it's not really about which City player you want, and it's much more about, do you make an early transfer or not? And that's almost how I read this. And the fact of the matter is, with League Cup and Europa League happening this week, I wouldn't be making a transfer until Thursday if I can avoid it. And if that precludes me from getting one of KDB or Sterling, if I was in that position, maybe so be it. The fact of the matter is, as well, is that Wolves, they looked quite good against Sheffield United, and although Sheffield United did spurn chances that you'd expect City to finish, at the same time, I'm not thinking it's like the end of the world if I don't have one of those two in my team next week, whereas I would think that, you know, further down the line. But as well, I also presume the player that you're selling here, it's probably Mane or something, it's an elite midfielder anyway, or else you're taking hits. Either way, I'd probably give them a chance. Like, they're a pretty good player, whoever it is that you're trying to sell. But okay, then focusing on the actual question itself, I'd probably just go for KDB. I just think he's just that much better.
Fair enough. I said in the preseason that maybe KDB had had one of those Annus Mirabilis's, and maybe he had his Yaya Touré year. Who knows? I mean, he does have those penalties, and he does have the assists, does have the goals, and does have the bonus potential. But I guess I'd be looking at Sterling. I think that I'd be very interested in him, actually. Him and Salah being my two premiums probably is where I'm going at the moment, just because goals over assists. I know it's a bit strange, but I think like kind of everyone's going to be going on KDB. I think by game week 3, there's going to be such huge ownership for KDB already, just out of last year and just out of kind of name recognition. Sterling did very, very well in the restart, don't forget. But I just think that Sterling will be one of those characters, I think, who is going to be catching the ball and really get you those explosive returns. And the same with last season. Obviously, last season, during kind of before the lockdown, he was an absolute pain in the ass to own. Don't get me wrong. But during the restart, I think he definitely kind of resurged as being Man City's main threat. And I think that going forward as well, I'd be hoping for him to build on that form. I might be wrong. I might end up having to get KDB in. But in the short term at least, I think I'll be buying Sterling. But let's see when we get to game week 3, and see if I even want to be selling Aubameyang at that point. But there's only so long I think we can be able to go without Man City, given the volume of goals from that team.
Yeah, one thing to throw in maybe about Sterling, just to add, he only got 6 assists last season, and that followed a 15 and a 17 assist seasons the years before that. The fact of the matter is that, you know, in whilst he did score 20 goals, the most in his career, there is that whole other side to his game that he probably hasn't utilised, where there's, I don't know, there's probably 30 points worth of just left behind there in terms of assists, presumably because of the likes of Gabriel Jesus, or just basically not having Aguero in the side for quite a lot of the season, that you'd think that he would be able to add to his assist tally. And his goal scoring was effectively all happened in 8 weeks at the start and the end of the season. You take those out and there's this huge barren period that you think he would fill in again. So the arguments for Sterling are quite big, and I think his ceiling is higher than De Bruyne. And I think you're really quite on the button with the idea that maybe De Bruyne did have his Yaya Touré year, and the fact of the matter is Sterling does have more to him. I've swayed myself in a very short amount of time, basically.
Right, so we're going to move on to Liverpool now. And Tony D asked us a question: if the Leeds match has changed our view on Trent and the Liverpool defence. Relatedly, Sherlock Shadman also asked us if what are we considering to do with Mane. I'm actually going to let you guys answer that one first, and then I'm going to talk about what I'm thinking about doing.
Right, I'll jump on first. So before your big reveal, Nick. Okay, so the fact of the matter is, I think Trent Alexander-Arnold, he looked pretty unfit, a bit of a worry, of course, but at the same time, he still created plenty of chances. Those would improve as the time goes on. His balls were a bit off, his energy was down. That'll come. I'm okay with that. He was outshone by Robbo on the day in underlying stats, in points, etc. That happened in Project Restart too, and you could start to say, is there a trend? Maybe there is, but I'm not too concerned just yet. Liverpool's XG from open play was, of course, much worse in the restart than it was in the earlier 29 weeks of the season. It went up from 0.76 goals, expected goals conceded from open play per game, to 0.91 expected goals conceded from open play per game. That's 19% higher for those who want that. And they only got 3 clean sheets in those 9 games as well. So pretty big difference. The Leeds game. Leeds did well. They had long spells in possession. They were unfortunate not to take something from the game on the day as it played out, and of course Liverpool did have penalties, and we've talked enough about that. But at the end of the day, Leeds had 6 shots, 3 of them went on target, and 3 of those went into the net. Very few teams would have that sort of good fortune. No matter how you put it, that is quite fortunate, and I don't want to take away anything from Leeds' performance, but Liverpool weren't that bad defensively, and a few uncharacteristic errors led to Leeds finding their way into that game,
definitely,
which I think will be ironed out quite quickly.
Oh, that Van Dijk gift for Paddy B is high in mind there. So I'd echo kind of what you said there, Anthony. I think the Liverpool defence as well, TAA obviously did nothing, but Robertson got an assist, Van Dijk got a goal. Like, that in itself highlights what you'd expect from Liverpool defence. If there's no clean sheets, you've always got that threat of an attacking return. obviously Robertson's been doing a bit, little bit better than TAA had been throughout the restart. TAA wasn't as fit, I don't think, but he's got enough credit in the bank, as it were, to give him time. And I'd probably be saying the same with Mane. And I think that that, I don't know, I mean, it's obviously a bit unlucky this week, and it's obviously a bit annoying if you own Mane and Salah got all the plaudits, but at the end of the day, you've got to give it love. I think with these guys, give it another week. Like we've seen so many times in the past that if it's Salah, if it's Salah's turn one week, it's Mane's the next. Nick's dubbed this the red roulette in the past, and it's completely true. And it could be, you know, next week, Chelsea, there's a dearth of chances, and you need the guy who scores the low XG chance. That is Mane. So it could be that. I mean, there's one more question here as well. It was Edwin Ambrose who says, is Luca Dean in an idea or is it too early? And I think that might apply to a member of the podcast team here. Nick, what are you thinking of doing here?
So yeah, I am planning something slightly controversial and slightly out of character, perhaps, considering everything I've said in the preseason. So just to give some context, quite close to the deadline, I was improving my team. I kind of lost my nerve with Saka and put in Suchek, and ended up also doing Doherty to Virgil van Dijk, which ended up just being a net gain of 1 point because Saka didn't play, but it meant Mitchell coming off the bench. But that, besides the point, I now have a scenario where I've got double Liverpool defence, both Virgil and Trent. And I'm looking at their upcoming games and I'm not seeing, you know, double clean sheets there because they've got Chelsea and they've got Arsenal. And what I do know is Chelsea aren't particularly great defensively. Arsenal aren't particularly great defensively. I can see Virgil threatening again in that box. He had a couple of chances in that last game. One of them he scored, the other was close and just missed. What I also saw is that Trent seemed to be giving up a little bit of his responsibility on those set pieces to Robertson. Even Robertson took a couple of the corner. Oh, he took at least one corner on the right hand side as well, and took a free kick from distance, which ended up in an assist. And that was my concern with Trent. He definitely seemed a little bit off the boil, and because of that, I'm actually considering selling him for the creator in chief, Luca Dean, that you mentioned.
Yeah, you can leave the senses.
This is outrageous, perhaps, but you know, clean sheets, I've got that covered with Virgil van Dijk. I can bring in, you know, another. I'm always fan of a defender that creates chances, and Luca Dean's stats were excellent last season for creating chances, weren't they? They were only second to Trent. He's 1.5 million cheaper. He has better fixtures than Trent, with West Brom, Crystal Palace, and Brighton up next. So I've got 1.5 million to spend. I've still got my Liverpool defender and Virgil van Dijk. And you know, we talk about, oh, Trent is high risk, everyone owns or whatever, but he's only in two seasons of data, he's only outscored Virgil by 9 points. So I feel like the 1 million saving there is viable as well. And certainly Virgil van Dijk, he's so dangerous in the air. Any goal he gets is the equivalent of two TAA assists, just to add to that point.
Thursday, the 26th of December, 2019.
24-pointer at Leicester, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Could easily blow up in my face, this one, but I'm tempted, I'm not going to lie. And yeah, I've at least got some coverage there for the clean sheet element of the 24 points, which would be six of them.
Sounds very tasty. And I think it definitely feeds into the final question this week, which is Strats Intact. FPL PTSD asks us, are we still sticking to our strategies? And I think this is actually quite an interesting one, because he says, is anyone wavering? Well, Nick certainly seems to be, to some extent.
I don't think I'm wavering here, because I think my strategy was strong game week one. That worked out all right. And maximum flexibility to make changes.
My strategy was to do well.
My strategy was just to show up. Yeah. All right.
I'm definitely tapping my head here and saying, you can't follow a strategy if you don't have a strategy. Think of that meme.
Yeah. Okay, that's a sync from both of you. My initial strategy was to get to game week three and then reassess. I know, it was just so deep. All of our strategies were so deeply thought out, weren't they? Exactly.
There have been other years, and we talked about this last week, so I don't want to bore people to death, where I've had like this spreadsheet with 10 weeks. I'm like, I'm going to move this guy here, and then they're playing the promoted team there, and it's all like blows up.
We all know it's rubbish. I mean, have we seen the words defensive rotation cited anywhere this week? Absolutely not, because it's already gone out the window, hasn't it? Let's be fair. But I mean, in terms of strategies, I did say I'm going to try to get to game week three with two or three transfers and reassess. Kai Havertz this evening was not really what I want for an 8.5 million. James Rodriguez probably was what I'm looking for from a player in that price bracket. And the next three for Everton are pretty good. They've got West Brom, Crystal Palace and Brighton. I don't know if I'm going to be able to resist that. I don't know if I'm going to be able to resist it. So it looks like these two didn't have a strategy in the first place. So who knows if they're sticking or not. They'll claim if it suits them, they're sticking to it. If it doesn't suit them, they'll just be like, well, I didn't have a strategy anyway. And then I'm being open and honest about the fact that maybe I may change my strategy, because in the past, doing WGTA, I've kind of gone, oh, I've got to stick to it. I've said it, I'm going to do it. And it's really screwed me up. So this year, meh, who cares? Right, let's move on to transfers and captains. And I've already mentioned mine, so I'm going to kind of go on ahead a little bit more. Langer Schlanger asked me, am I playing Reece James, as a final sort of question for this week's pod? I don't know yet is the answer, because I didn't plan to be playing him. I planned to have him on the bench because I had Luke Ailing in wait on the bench to come on. Fulham at home, so my back line is Trent, who Nick's going to be selling, so I'm looking forward to those differential points. Ailing and Justin at the back. Do I want Reece James? Oh, but he did look very good. It's good to own him, but I think I'm going to bench him. But I think the big thing I'll be doing is maybe selling Havertz and maybe bringing in James Rodriguez. I don't know yet, but that is kind of what I'm planning on doing. I think I'm finding it very hard to resist that. And just looking at Kai, how he played today, I'm sure Lampard's not going to play him on the wing again because he was so ineffective, so peripheral. But he just smacked with the player who's just coming to grips with the new league a lot more than Werner did. And I think it might be the case just correcting that mistake. I think Kai may be very, very good going forward. He may even punish me against Liverpool. But based on what I've seen so far, I may be kind of thinking, yeah, you know what? It's not quite time for him yet. Maybe I'll go back to him later on in the year. But for now, I'm very much considering putting James Rodriguez in. And Aubameyang captain. What do you guys think?
So for me, I guess, whilst not having a strategy, I was thinking that I had Danny Ings in my side and he was probably the one who was going to go. I kept 0.5 in the bank that would allow me to go up to Tony Martial or down to Richarlison, depending on what I felt like doing. And I think it'll be one of those two moves is what I'll do this week, and just fits my team shape quite nicely. It does mean that going into this week, I'm going to be playing a 5-2-3, which sounds kind of daft, but I have pretty good fixtures across my back five and Ramsdale is there too, so I'm happy enough to go through with that.
Oh, the hourglass.
Yep.
Ramsdale, interesting. So yeah, I'm going for Aubameyang captain as well. I think obviously he's the main man, isn't he? West Ham at home. West Ham were pretty terrible in the opening game. He's definitely getting the armband again, so he's the captain for me. As I said, for my transfer, I am tempted to do Trent for Luca Dean. Yeah, jumping on that same Everton bandwagon as Tom, only slightly different format. Certainly can't sell the likes of Salah. He's too good for me. And I'm playing. I also have Luke Eiling actually, so he's coming into the starting 11. And I'm kicking out Thomas Suchek, who's going to be my first sub there. Cool. So we were Who Got the Assist. Thanks so much for listening, guys. If you're new listener and enjoyed the pod this week, don't forget to hit that subscribe button and you'll have us in your ears all season long. And if you haven't joined the mini league, the code is CPSULF.
And if you've enjoyed listening to this pod, please do leave a rating. It helps us with algorithms and all that jazz and getting this into more people's ears. So we'd really appreciate that. Also, if you have correspondence for the correspondence section, whogottheassist@gmail.com, please email, because the guys will call it. Please. We are back next week with our special guest, Late Riser. Very exciting to have him on the pod.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be chasing upsides with him and catching up with him. And I guess next week will be the time when a lot of wild cards are going to be played, game week three. So yeah, absolutely fantastic. And yeah, we're really looking forward to that pod with Late Riser. But in the meantime, I hope this is you. Think about penalties in FPL going forward. Good luck in game week two and speak to you next week. Goodbye.
Slán.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.